17. Pirates and Teams. The front of her Mondrian haircut had started to remind her of Bobby Chombo's elephantiasis of the forelock, the result of an ongoing interaction of product with particulates. Whatever the stylist had applied had by now sucked in every molecule of the brew that was the air of the LA basin, plus however many cigarettes Bobby Chombo had recently smoked in her immediate vicinity. None of this looks very good, she thought, meaning not so much the generally poor appearance she felt she was able to muster to meet her new employer, but the overall arc and apparent direction of her life so far. Everything, right that minute, down to Chombo and his gridded floor. Chombo afraid to sleep in the same grid square twice. But still, lip gloss, earrings, top and skirt and hose from the worse-for-wear Barney's bag she was using to separate dress-up from workaday. For a purse, she chose one of her black makeup bags, dumped it, refilled it minimally. The shoes from the dress-up bag were mutant black ballet slippers by a Catalan designer long since gone into some other field. Out of here, she told the woman in the mirror, once again ignoring the video art in the elevator. The door opened on the buzz and tinkle of Stark's lobby in late-evening bar mode. A brown-haired bellman, in trademark pale suit, stood centred in the projected faux-Islamic squiggles of the carpet of light device, smiling mightily in her direction. This functionary's teeth, illuminated by the accidental fall of a single sunny squiggle, were presented with billboard clarity. As she approached him, scanning for her Belgian advertising magnate, the smile increased in both width and magnitude, till, as she was about to pass, the luxurious tones last heard on her cell emerged, startling her. "Miss Henry? Hubertus Bigend." Instead of screaming, she took his hand, finding it firm, dry, and of a neutral temperature. He squeezed hers lightly in return, his smile expanding still further. "Pleased to meet you, Mr. Bigend." "Hubertus," he insisted, "please. Are you finding the hotel satisfactory?" "Yes, thanks." What she had taken for a Mondrian doorman suit was crisp beige wool. His sky blue shirt was open at the collar. "Shall we try Skybar?" he asked, consulting a watch the size of a small ashtray. "Unless you'd prefer something here." He indicated the high, narrow, surrealistically long alabaster table, atop some number of tall, biomorphic Stark legs, that was the lobby bar. "There's safety in numbers," said an inner voice, that wanted to stay right here, have the required drink, and the absolute polite minimum of talk. "Skybar," she opted. Not certain why, but recalling that it might well be impossible to get in, let alone get a table. As he led her toward the pool and the shed-sized flower pots, each with its ficus tree, she recalled fragments from the last few times she'd been here, at the end of, and just after, the curfew's official cessation. People who didn't know the music industry, Inchmel said, believed that the movie business was the ne plus ultra of vicious, asshole-chewing, hyena-like behaviour. They passed a Brobdingnagian futon, in whose squishy depths a covey of vicious, asshole-chewing, hyena-like, and exceptionally pretty young people reclined with their drinks. "But you don't know that about them," she reminded herself. "It was just that they looked like A&R people. But then, almost everyone here did." He led her past the bouncer, as though the bouncer weren't there. Indeed, the Bluetooth bouncer was hard-pressed to get out of Big End's way in time, so thoroughly did it seem that Big End was unaccustomed to anyone being in his way. The bar was packed, as she remembered it having always been, but he had no trouble getting them a table. Looking broad, bright-eyed, and, she supposed, Belgian. He held her heavy, library-style oak chair for her. "I was quite a fan of the curfew," he said to her ear. "And a huge goth altogether, I'll bet," she resisted replying. The idea of a baby Belgian advertising magnate raising his bic in some darkened curfew concert was best left unexamined. These days, according to Inchmail, they raised their cell phones, and the screens gave out quite a startling amount of light. "Thank you," she said, leaving it ambiguous as to whether she was thanking him for having told her he'd like the curfew, or for having held her chair. Seated opposite her now, beige elbows on the table, manicured fingers steepled in front of him, he was managing a good approximation of the look she was given by male Hollis Henry aficionados, who were actually seeing some private inner vision of Anton Corbijn's portrait of her, the one in the deconstructed tweed miniskirt. "My mother," he began, on an unexpected note, "enjoyed the curfew immensely. She was a sculptor, Phaedra Seinhave. When I visited her Paris studio for the last time, she was playing you, loudly." He smiled. "Thank you." She decided not to go with a dead mother. "But I'm a journalist now. No credentials to coast on there." "Roush is very pleased with you as a journalist," he said. "He wants you on staff." Their waiter arrived and went away for Hollis's gin tonic and Big N's Piso Mojado, a new one on Hollis. "Tell me about Node," she suggested. "It doesn't seem to be generating much in the way of industry gossip."
"No?"
"No." He lowered his finger steeple.
"Anti-buzz," he said. "Definition by absence."
She waited to see if he'd indicate that he was joking. He didn't.
"That's ridiculous."
The smile unshattered, gleamed, shuttered, and then their drinks arrived, in disposable plastic that protected the hotel against barefoot poolside litigations. She afforded herself a quick scan of the rest of the clientele. "Were a cruise missile just then to impact the corrugated roof of Skybar," she decided, "there would be no great need for people to change its next cover." The fancy, as Inchmail had called them, seemed to have moved on. Just as well, for present purposes.
"Tell me," she said, leaning slightly forward over her gin.
"Yes?"
"Chambo. Bobby Chambo. Why did Roush make such a point of my meeting him?"
"Roush is the story's editor," he said mildly. "Perhaps you should ask him."
"Something else is going on," she pressed. She felt as though she were marching out to confront the Mongolian deathworm on its own ground.
Probably not that good an idea, but somehow she knew she must.
"His urgency didn't feel to me like part of the story."
Big N studied her.
"Ah, well, part of another story then. A much bigger one. Your second Node story, we hope. And you've just come from meeting him. Chombo?"
"Yes."
"And what did you think?"
He knows something nobody else does.
Or thinks he does.
And what do you think that might be, Hollis? May I call you Hollis?"
"Please do. I don't think Bobby's all that keen on his position in any locative avant-garde. He likes being on top of any breaking phenomenon, I'd guess, but is basically bored with the grunt work. When he was helping to invent the context of the locative thing, to whatever extent he did, he probably wasn't bored."
Big N's smile opened again. It reminded her of the lights in another train when trains pass at night, going in opposite directions. Then it closed. It was like she'd entered a tunnel.
"Go on."
He sipped his Piso, which looked a lot like NyQuil.
And it's not DJing, she said, or making mashups, or whatever else he does publicly. It's whatever makes him mark the floor of that factory, according to the GPS grid. He won't sleep in the same square twice. Whatever makes him confident he's important is also what's making him crazy.
And that might be?
She thought of the wire-framed cargo container. How Chombo had so abruptly tried to yank the helmet off her head, almost pulling her over. She hesitated.
Pirates, he said.
Pirates?
The Straits of Malacca and the South China Sea. Small, fast boats, preying on cargo vessels. They operate from lagoons, coves, islets, the Malay Peninsula, Java, Borneo, Sumatra.
She looked from Big End to the crowd around them, feeling like she'd fallen into someone else's pitch meeting. A ghostly studio logline, left to hover near the bar's massively timbered, corrugated ceiling, had fallen on her, the first likely victim to sit at this table. The pirate movie.
Arr,
she said, meeting his gaze again and downing the last of her gin tonic.
Maidy.
Real pirates, Hubertus Big End said, unsmiling.
Most of them, anyway.
Most?
Some of them were part of a covert CIA maritime program.
He put his empty plastic glass down, as though it was something he was considering bidding on at Sotheby's. He framed it with his fingers, a director considering a shot.
Stopping suspect cargo vessels to search for weapons of mass destruction.
He looked up at her, unsmiling. Irony free? He nodded. A tiny movement, very precise. Thus perhaps did Diamond Factor's nod in Antwerp, she thought. This isn't bullshit, Mr. Big End.
It's as expensively quasi-factual as I can afford it to be. Material like this tends to squirm a bit, as you can well imagine. One rather deep irony, I suppose, is that this program, which had apparently been fairly effective, fell victim to blowback from your domestic political struggles here. Prior to certain revelations, though, and to the name of a cover company being made public, CIA teams, disguised as pirates, accompanied real pirates boarding merchant vessels suspected of smuggling weapons of mass destruction. Using radiation detectors and other things, they inspected cargo holds and containers, while the real pirates took whatever more mundane cargo they chose to acquire. That was the payoff for the pirates, that they could have their pick of cargo, provided the teams were given a first look at all of the holds and containers.
Containers?
Yes. Pirates and teams provided one another with mutual backup. The teams would have amply bribed any local authorities, and of course the US Navy would stay well away when one of these operations was underway. The ship's crews were never the wiser, whether contraband was discovered or not. If something were found, the interdiction came later, nothing to do with our pirates.
He gestured to a waiter for another piso.
Another drink?
Mineral water, she said. Joseph Conrad. Kipling. Or a movie.
The pirates who proved best at this were out of Aceh, in northern Sumatra. Prime Conrad territory, I believe.
Were they finding much, the faux pirates?
The Diamond Factor's nod again.
Why are you telling me this?
In August 2003, one of these joint CIA pirate operations boarded a freighter with Panamanian registry, bound from Iran to Macau. The team's interest centered on one particular container. They'd broken its seals, opened it, when orders came by radio to leave it.
Leave it?
Leave the container. Leave the vessel. Those orders were followed, of course.
Who told you that story?
Someone who claims to have been a member of the boarding team.
And you think that Chombo, somehow,
has something to do with that.
I suspect, Begin said, leaning closer and lowering his voice, that Bobby periodically knows where that container is.
Periodically?
Apparently it's still out there, somewhere, Begin said. Like the Flying Dutchman.
His second piezo arrived, along with her water.
To your next story, he toasted,
touching the rims of their fresh plastic glasses. The pirates.
Yes.
Did they see what was in it?
No. Most people don't self-drive these, Begin said, pulling out onto Sunset, headed east.
Most people don't drive them at all,
Hollis corrected, from the passenger seat beside him. She craned her neck for a glimpse back into what she supposed could be called the passenger cabin. There seemed to be a sort of frosted skylight, as opposed to any mere moonroof, and a lot of very glossy wood, the rest in carbon-coloured lambskin.
A Brabus Maybach,
he said, as she turned her head in time to see him give the wheel a little pat.
The firm of Brabus extensively tweaks the product of Maybach to produce one of these.
Darth my ride.
If you were riding him back, you could watch for locative art on the monitors in each front seat back. There's MWAN and a fourplex GPRS router.
No thanks.
The seats back there, upholstered in that gunmetal lamb, obviously reclined, becoming beds, or possibly chairs, for high-end elective surgery. Through the smoke glass at her side, she saw pedestrians at the intersection, staring at the Maybach. The light changed, and Big End pulled away. The vehicle's interior was still as a museum at midnight.
"Do you always drive this?" she asked.
"The agency has Phaetons," he said. "Good stealth cars. Mistake them for jetters at a distance."
"I'm not a car person."
She ran her thumb along a lambskin seat seam. "Like touching the butt of a supermodel, probably."
"Why have you decided to interest yourself in journalism, if you don't mind my asking?"
"Looking for a way to make a living. Curfew royalties don't amount to much. I haven't been that talented an investor."
"Few people are," he said. "If they're successful at it, of course, then they imagine they are. Talented. But they're all doing the same things, really."
"I wish someone had told me what they're doing in that case."
"If you need to earn money, there are more lucrative fields than journalism."
"Are you discouraging me?"
"Not at all. I'm simply encouraging you in a broader way. I'm interested in what motivates you and how you understand the world."
He glanced sideways at her.
"Rausch tells me you've written about music."
"60s garage bands. I started writing about them when I was still in the curfew."
"Were they an inspiration?"
She was watching a 14-inch display on the Maybach's dash, the red cursor that was the car proceeding along the green line that was Sunset. She looked up at him.
"Not in any linear way, musically. They were my favourite bands."
"Are," she corrected herself. He nodded. She glanced back down at the dash display and found the street map gone, replaced by wireframe diagrams of a helicopter, its bulbous profile unfamiliar. Now it appeared above the wireframe profile of a ship, either a small ship or quite a large helicopter, cut to video of the actual aircraft in flight.
"What's this?"
"The Hook, so-called. It's an older Soviet-made helicopter, one with tremendous lifting capacity. Syria owns at least one of them."
The Hook, or another just like it, was lifting a Soviet tank now, as if in demonstration.
"Drive," she ordered. "Don't be watching your own PowerPoint."
Cut to a colourful, simplified animation, illustrating how a helicopter, not looking very Hook-like, could shuffle cargo containers on the deck and in the holds of a freighter.
"The container in your story,"
she began.
Yes.
Did they say whether it was very heavy?
It's not, that we know of, said Big End. But it's sometimes at the centre of a stack of much heavier containers. That's a very secure position, as there's ordinarily no way at all, at sea, to access a container in that position. The hook, though, would allow you to do that. Plus, you could have arrived from somewhere else, another ship, say, with your container hooked. Decent cruising range. Reasonably fast.
He got onto the 101 freeway, southbound. The Maybach suspension turned the pockmarked pavement into something silken, smooth as warm fudge. She could sense the car's power now, held effortlessly in check. On the dash display, lines symbolising signals were being emitted by a shipping container. They rose at a sharp angle, to be intercepted by a satellite, which bounced them back down, past the curve of the Earth.
Where are we going, Mr. Big End?
Hubertus. To the agency. It's a better place to discuss things.
Agency?
Blue Ant.
And here, on the display now, unmoving and crisply hieroglyphic, was that insect itself. Blue. She looked back up at him. His profile vaguely reminded her of someone.